Good evening, everyone. I'm Harold Fisher. This is part two of our special three-part series on the Daily Drum, Justice in Black and White, an examination of issues that have come into focus since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Tonight's focus, the two pandemics, preventing further harm and healing the pain. This program can be heard on 96.3 WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, WHUR.com, and streaming on all of our digital platforms. Tonight's program will also be rebroadcast at 10 o'clock on our sister station, WHUT-TV, Channel 32. Now, of course, we are not taking any phone calls tonight, but you can join the conversation using the hashtag WHURFM. My guest tonight are Dr. Reed Tuckson, Chair of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19 and Howard University Trustee, Dr. Niambi Carter, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University, and author of the book, American While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship. Also with us, Timothy Williams, an expert in police procedure, use of force, and wrongful convictions. And finally, we have the Reverend Mark Thompson, civil rights organizer. I want to thank all of you for sharing in this really important conversation. I want to get right into this. Let me first start with you, Timothy. Talk to me a little bit about where you see we are right now. Where do we go from this point? We've had the protests and unfortunately the civil unrest. We had the funeral for George Floyd today in Minneapolis. What's the next step?
Well, the next step, and thanks for having me. The next step is that we've got to come to the table. When I say we, the stakeholders in the community, you got to bring the faith community, you've got to bring the educational community, you've got to bring the business community, you got to bring law enforcement, you got to bring all the stakeholders that make a community, and come to the table and do some meaningful discussion, and with that discussion, implement meaningful and concise reform in the criminal justice system. Secondly, there needs to be a federal oversight in the law enforcement organizations under this administration. We will not see that. I'm talking about in the area of consent decrees, and hopefully that will come back, because those consent decrees have teeth. They have federal oversight by the federal courts, and things can be mandated. The third thing is that, as it relates to the coherent change in the system, is that you've got to look at what's coming in the system. When I say coming in the system, those individuals who are becoming officers, making sure that they have the proper core values. And then the fourth thing is that you need to have proper leadership. Leadership is key. I can't overemphasize that. You have, and I don't want to paint anyone with a broad brushstroke, but you have good chiefs out there. Then you have chiefs that should even be running an organization that don't have a coherent or creative thought in their mind. And what you see, they go from one agency to another, and you recycle the same bad leadership all across the country. Then you have to, with that leadership, you have to hold supervision accountable. You have to hold, that's the frontline management, you have to hold the watch commanders accountable, you have to hold the commanding officers accountable. At the end of the day, everything falls at the feet of that chief. And the fifth thing is the civic responsibility. These mayors hire and appoint these chiefs. The city council ratifies their decision, and all these are elected officials. Well, that means that the public has to come out and question these individuals and vote coherently. In other words, you got to put square pegs in square holes and quit putting round pegs in square holes.
Well, let me ask Dr. Carter about this, because I think the important thing about that, I think that's some really great foundational stuff. But we have the political will today, but America has short memories. Will we have the political will tomorrow, literally Friday or July or after November?
Well, I mean, I think this is the perennial question, because this is not the first time we've been here, right? I mean, we can talk about Rodney King. We can talk about Freddie Gray just a few years ago. We've been in this place before, maybe not quite to this extent, because we've never had COVID-19 before. But we've certainly been in this place before, and we've seen many of the same results, because people talk a good game, right? And we think leadership changes lead to better outcomes. But I think part of the issue here is that there is something really rotten in this system, right? And you can change all the leadership you want. You can change all the members of the city council that you want. But we have to really talk about what's sort of undergirding all of it. Violence, in a sense, right? If you don't view Black people as fully human, then it's very difficult to think about humane strategies to working with that community. And I think this is part of what that conversation is missing. So yes, all of the things that we can pull in terms of the levers of politics will get us so far, but these sort of fundamental questions about how people think about these communities that they are entering and who lives there, and whether those people are all sort of criminals until proven otherwise, I think are the deeper issues that we are needing to engage with, and which some of these protesters are talking about, right? When they're talking about defund the police, they don't mean like, hey, we want the police gone altogether, but they're talking about how do we get to the root causes of things that lead to maybe criminal activity or even mischief, right? Not even things that rise to the level of crime, but maybe nuisances, right? How do we get here? Right, so we can avoid people having contact with the criminal justice system. And I think these are the kinds of questions that keep coming up over and over and over again. And we also have to deal with police unions, right? I mean, in many cities and many localities, police unions exercise an extraordinary amount of power. And I think that is also a problem, because if nobody can police the police, then that leaves the citizens much more vulnerable, right, than they would be otherwise. And so I think there are a lot of things that politics can do, but there are also things that we have to do as a community if we want to soul search and figure out, and politics can't fix those.
Mark, let me talk to you specifically, you know, as a civil rights activist, we've long heard that we cannot legislate prejudice. So how do we fix the obvious issues that have arisen over the past several weeks as it relates to prejudice? I mean, even today, it came out that in court, that the men behind the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia uttered a racial epithet during his last seconds on earth. How do we fix that?
Well, first of all, let me thank you all for having me here on WHUR and Miss HUR, Mr. Daily Drum, and all the good work that was done.
Well, thank you so much.
I should also say it's meaningful to be here in the very building, or the very building adjacent to where you are. That's the building I was born in when my mother was a senior at Howard University. So the School of C, Kathy Hughes School of Communications is in my blood.
Okay.
You know, you can't legislate this away. I agree, and greetings to all of your esteemed guests, all of whom I admire. It's going to be necessary to organize, but especially on the local level. Police are governed locally, and unfortunately, the struggle against police violence, to your point, Harold, you know, we tend to move on. But we move on because sometimes I think the way we approach it is from 30,000 feet in the air. And today that's even more so because, you know, social media is great, but social media can't necessarily touch the politics on the ground. And I'm hearing from young people and those who work with young people that they are so upset with everything right now, and so upset with the system. Once again, no surprise, we're having the conversation with young people. They're asking, what is the point in voting? Because nothing ever changes. So we've got a lot of education to do to show that when you vote, especially local level, you affect the local elected officials, mayor, city council, et cetera, county commissioners, city commissioners that pick these chiefs of police that help to determine policy. And so it's going to take that. I don't know that we know when racism will end or where we'll change people's hearts. These are good signs, though, because people all over the world, black and white and other races and colors and creeds, are standing up and putting their bodies on the line, even in the midst of this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And as I think about the history of WHUR, you know, I remember every night WHUR and Subri Governor reported from the battlefront in apartheid South Africa. As long as Donald Trump's in office, as long as we're being lynched in this modern day way, we're in an apartheid state. And so when I was on the BBC this week and they asked, what can we do? I'll say this, some of us have begun a conversation about bringing the band back together. We may have to go to the world community in the way that our sisters and brothers in South Africa did and ask them to continue to cry out on our behalf, one, but also to seriously consider a divestment campaign from this country as long as Donald Trump is in office and as long as this police terror reigns. We need help, and it's going to take a lot.
Let me talk to Dr. Tuckson. Dr. Tuckson, from your position, you know, as a physician, and you and I have spoken on this program before about the first pandemic of 2020, which is COVID-19. I'm sure you saw the funeral for George Floyd in Minneapolis, and snippets of it. Were you at all concerned about the threat of the coronavirus during the course of that service? There was little social distancing. There was a lot of touching, handshakes, hugs, the like.
It's a great question. And let's be real clear that these are some very, very torturous kinds of issues to work through. I think I understand that moral outrage requires moral responsibility, that there is no question that the case for protest is made. It is there. It is legitimate. It is clear. It is unequivocal. On the other hand, just as the case for the coming together to honor our brother at the funeral, the question for community and public grieving, it's there. It's unequivocal. However, yes, you have to be concerned about that, as well as what's happening with some of the elements of the protest, because it is inevitable that this kind of coming together and the way that we are coming together, whether it's through the funeral or through some of the elements of the protest, will inevitably cause more people to transmit the virus. And we already are experiencing an extraordinary, disproportionate impact of that virus on our people. So I think we have a very fine line to walk. And what I would continue to say, and we will, I'm sure, get into more details as the conversation unfolds, but what is the morally responsible way to exhibit your moral outrage through protest? And that really becomes something that we have to have a very serious conversation. And I hope as the conversation evolves, we can get into some of that.
Well, let's talk about that. You know, I'll go back to you, you know, Dr. Carter. How do you balance that, the two pandemics, as it relates to the focus of this conversation, where you have a concern about people getting sick, particularly Black folks who have been disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus, and Black folks who have been disproportionately impacted by racism in this country?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting that on the day that we lay Mr. Floyd to rest, it was also revealed that he has survived COVID-19, right? I think that's something to think about. I mean, I don't know what the appropriate response is, because again, we're talking about a virus that kills Black people at three times the rate as it does white Americans. And these are things that are really concerning, especially when we talk about things like funerals and gatherings where you want to be close to other people, where you're in a protest, where you actually are arm in arm in some cases with other people. I think we would be remiss if we talked about the police violence without talking about the COVID-19, because to me, they are both symptoms of the same source, right? The same thing that makes Black people more vulnerable to this is the same disregard for Black life that makes them more vulnerable to police violence. So I think it's a difficult thing to tell people, hey, don't protest, there's a pandemic. But it's also irresponsible to suggest that the pandemic is solved. We know we've had a woefully inadequate response in this country to this pandemic, and this is a very real threat to those people's lives. So in addition to fighting off or working through the militarized police forces in some of these cities that are being deployed to manage, right, these protesters, we're also talking about the fact that people are likely putting themselves at risk in these very same protests for COVID-19. So it's a double-edged sword. I don't think that social justice can wait. At the same time, how do we exercise the caution that is needed at this time? Because we know it's still a very dangerous time. We have not gotten this thing under control by any stretch. And these very same communities that are out here protesting are many of those same communities that are especially vulnerable to this virus.
Timothy, you saw the video, as we all have, the last minutes of George Floyd's life. Black people have been saying in this country since the very beginning of organized policing that there are difficult elements in police departments. How do you separate the wheat from the chaff in that regard?
Well, you know, I was on the department in 1992 when we had the Los Angeles riots, and at the end of the riots, we've heard the same discussion, and 28 years later, we're here with the demise of George Floyd, and we're having the same discussion. Having been in this business going on 48 years, I kind of know the issues and the handles and the things that need to be addressed. You know, I wrote a book, a deep dive, an expert analysis of police procedure and use of force and wrongful convictions. And I talk about these things. I talked about the same issue that George Floyd died on, and the deep dive that goes into analysis of all that. But the thing is that, you know, Dr. King said, and I think it's rightly so, and it has that phrase has withstood the ages. We as a people have a hypertension of words and anemia of deeds. In other words, we do a whole lot of talking and really nothing follows through. So I'm hoping that 6 months from now, a year from now, that the same police officers, the same firefighters, the same community is still taking that right knee. I'm hoping 6 months from now, a year from now, that there'll be some meaningful dialogue, not only dialogue, but some action to shake, to make change in this criminal justice system in our country. My thing is doing one city at a time, and guess what's going to happen? That one city is going to catch on to the next city, and the next city is going to catch on to the next city, and then you will see the change. But we got to quit talking, and we got to quit talking about it and be about it.
Well said. I just want to remind our viewers and listeners that this is part two of our special three-part series here on The Daily Drum, Justice in Black and White, an examination of issues that have come into focus since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And tonight's focus is the two pandemics, preventing further harm and healing the pain. Now, if you have a comment or a question, you can certainly send it to Facebook on WHUR's Facebook page. We certainly invite you to participate in this conversation. Of course, we will post that and try to address that conversation during the course of this conversation. I want to talk a little bit more about the protests, because is there any way, Dr. Tuckson, to protest safely right now? Cities are opening up, but whether they are opening up or not for business and some sense of new normalcy, right now the new normal continues to be tens of thousands of people in the street.
I think it's very important.
Heard and be safe.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's important that you also added that other context. In the middle of the protest movement going on, there's also the reopening. And it's also people deciding that they've had enough of being inside, so they're going out. So a lot of factors, all of which are negative to the spread of this disease is going forward. But if you have made the, first of all, the protesting community is multiple. Let's get rid of the agents and provocateurs. Those people need to leave us alone, get away. There's nothing to be said about those people whatsoever. There's some people, a few, who are out there simply because of entertainment purposes, and it's exciting. Those people are acting irresponsibly. These are not people with a moral outrage for whom moral responsibility is important. But the overwhelming majority of them, Harold, is what you're asking. The overwhelming majority of people on the streets are responsible people making a considered decision. If they're going to do that, number one, you've got to remember to wear your mask. It's absolutely true. Number two, add to your mask goggles. This pepper spray and those kinds of things are causing people to tear up, to cough, and to cry, and those bodily fluids get spread. Wow. So you've got to decide to wear a mask. Number three, you've got to do your best at social distancing. It makes no sense to crowd up a body to body up against a fence. That doesn't do anything. It doesn't make a good visual, and it's stupid and it will kill you. So stay back and keep your distance and walk apart from other people. Besides, it makes it look great. So many people in the line. Next thing is don't share megaphones and don't share water when you get home. And Dr. Carter made an important point. Not only are you risking yourself, I want to extend, Dr. Carter, you're risking everybody you know. So when you go home, make sure that you wash your clothes right away, you wash your hands. And if you are living with someone who is older or who has a pre-existing condition, you have to socially isolate yourself. You have no moral authority to protest and then kill somebody in your own family. Just like you can't breathe when a policeman puts his knee on your neck, we can't breathe when that virus comes into our alveolar sacs in our lungs and fills them with fluid. So if you have a moral imperative to criticize not being able to breathe in the society, you cannot take that home and cause the people in your own home not to be able to breathe. So we have to do all those things. And one last thing, we have to, and this is why I'm so irritated and angry at these agents and provocateurs who provoke the police to use these tear gas and other inhalants that cause this, the propensity of this disease to spread. Stay away from those crazy people. If you are in an environment where you see that, move. You're doing nothing but to hurt yourself and other people. But I would do all of those things. Wear your mask every single time you're there. But by the way, if you get caught with the tear gas, it's very difficult to wear your mask because you're irritated. Stay away from the crazy people. Don't get near where there has to be tear gas. It doesn't do any good. Wear your goggles, socially distance, don't crowd up, don't share megaphones, don't share water, wash everything. And if you're living around people that are vulnerable, you got to socially isolate. That's just the way the game goes.
Mm-hmm. Mark, let me ask you a similar question as it relates to this new civil rights, human rights protest, not just here in America, but now around the world, sparked by the horrific George Floyd video. What impact do you believe the COVID-19 pandemic is having on it? Would it be any different if there were no coronavirus right now?
Oh yeah, it'd be a whole lot different. And I agree with every word that Dr. Tuckson said and Brother Timothy said on this. First of all, I think it is very dangerous for people to be out demonstrating. I live here in the epicenter in New York. I have not been out for that reason, you know, as a middle-aged black man. Raising a son who graduates and turns 18 this weekend, I can't risk anything happening to me. Now, maybe after this weekend, because those of you who know me, this, you know, protest in the street is in my blood, but it's just too big of a risk. Now, maybe after his 18th birthday and graduation, I'll decide to go out Monday in a blaze of glory. But not only would that not be very responsible, it's very, very dangerous for everyone, even around the world. And I fear that there will be a spike after this. And again, that's where the challenge comes in, as Timothy was saying. As I said earlier, this happens on the local level. We have civilian complaint review, for example, in Washington, D.C., because we struggled at the local level. We came just short of, before Marion Barry left office, civilian oversight. And these are the type of things that communities need to struggle for. Colorchange.org, Movement for Black Lives, have been promoting these principles. The Zero Campaign have been promoting principles that local communities can get around, but it takes some discipline. I must say that we have to be very, very careful, all of us who are activists, that we don't mistake likes and shares and retweets and all of that on social media and reposts for actual tangible movement, all right? Because we see those numbers and we think that this is something, but we need to be right there on the ground in our local communities, putting pressure on entities within the community to withdraw financial support from the police department, to put pressure on city leaders, mayors, and what have you, to redistribute funds, our tax dollars, away from the police so that they'll stop lynching us. And then also put pressure locally on politicians not to be so beholden to these police unions. Now, we had a big breakthrough last week when the National Fraternal Order of Police even came out. I don't think they've ever done anything like this before. Even they admitted that the killing of George Floyd was wrong. But yeah, you know, those are things we can do in the long term that are even more important and more long standing and more effective than going out like, you know, in a flash in the pan in the middle of a pandemic and risking our lives.